This is Set Aside Some Time, an MSPN podcast, and it's brought to you by the National MSP Network, or MSPN for short. And now, on to the episode.
Thank you for setting aside some time with us today. My name is Annie Davidson, and I'm the Vice President of Client Success at ExamWorks Compliance Solutions. I'm also Vice President of the MSPN Board and honored and excited to host today's podcast. I have with me today Sid Wong, who is the Vice President of Policy at Verisk. We will be going through the fact pattern that we've been walking through this season with a focus on state specifics. So Sid, would you please introduce yourself a bit more to the audience?
Yes, thank you very much, Annie, and real pleasure to be here today. Very excited to discuss these fact patterns that we have. As Annie indicated, I am the Vice President of Policy at Verisk. I've been with the organization for 15 years, focusing solely on Medicare compliance. Throughout those years, I've worn a lot of hats, but currently primarily responsible for keeping abreast of all these Medicare compliance changes, updating our clients and our organization accordingly, developing best practices. And again, thank you very much, Annie, and looking forward to the discussion.
Awesome. Thanks, Sid. And never a dull day, right?
Never a
dull
day.
There's all sorts of things moving and shaking in the Medicare world. So, well, both Sid and I are attorneys by trade. We geek out on this. So we'll dive right in. I'll go over the general fact pattern that we've been following this year, and then we'll get right to the state specifics so that you can kind of hear what goes on all across the country as folks grapple with Medicare secondary payer compliance in their individual jurisdictions. So our fact pattern is Joe works for a flooring company installing carpeting. On November 5th, 2020, he was involved in a car accident while driving to a job site and he hurt his right knee. He reported the accident to his employer and headed off to the occupational health clinic for care. He had a right wrist contusion noted as well, along with that right knee sprain. A subsequent MRI of the right knee revealed a torn meniscus as well as osteoarthritis. Joe had a surgical repair of the torn meniscus on February 5th, 2021. He underwent a course of physical therapy and returned to work. His employer, the carrier, the work comp carrier, picked up the claim and paid out some medical and indemnity benefits for his claimed injury. So he returned to work for about 3 months. During that time, he continued to experience swelling in his right knee and felt that he was unable to perform his regular employment duties. His treating physician authorized him to take some time off of work and recommended a total knee replacement. So that's where we are in our fact pattern right now. He's sitting out there, you're a few years on, and he's got a recommendation for a total knee replacement. He begins now to complain of left knee pain and starts to complain again of pain in that right wrist. The total knee replacement at this point has been denied by the workers' compensation carrier here, and he has not gone ahead with it yet. He applied for Social Security disability and was awarded benefits. The work comp carrier and Joe now are discussing settlement options related to his claim. He will become a Medicare beneficiary in June of 2024 based on his Social Security disability status. So we are going to kind of do kind of, originally it was issue spotting, right? So if you've been listening to this series, you've heard several guests go through and talk about different issues to spot along the way. And today, Sid and I are going to be focusing on state-specific issues that we see, particularly around the idea of doing a Medicare set-aside for Joe. So I think, Sid, you want to kind of walk through why we would be talking about Medicare set-aside here? We know that Medicare, when you're looking to settle a work comp case, there are things we look for, right? We look for if the person's on Medicare or about to get on Medicare. Can you sort of walk us through what in this fact pattern says to you we should be looking at a Medicare set-aside as part of his settlement discussions?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have Joe here. He was injured at work, so we know it involves a workers' compensation claim. where there's a settlement that's being contemplated. I think that the parties, it's best practice to avoid, you know, the potential for cost shifting. That's really what the Medicare set-aside is intended to do. So here, we see this individual has been injured. They have a torn meniscus. The employer's been paying for benefits, so we know it's an accepted claim. The individual continues to still treat. It appears that there may be some not only exacerbations of that particular injury, but there are other body parts that may be you know, impacted as well. So based off of that, and the fact that Joe has applied for Social Security disability insurance, has received it, and as a result would be eligible for Medicare benefits after 24 months of receiving that as part of the fact pattern, we also see that, you know, it's been determined that they would be Medicare eligible in June of 2024. So based off that, Medicare would define this individual as having a reasonable expectation of Medicare enrollment within 30 months of settlement. And if the settlement exceeds, the total settlement amount exceeds $250,000, then Medicare would also review any Medicare set-aside that was submitted to them. So based off the fact that this person was injured at work, has a reasonable expectation, continues to treat, may potentially need a total knee replacement, even though it may be denied by the carrier, you know, it does relate to or does involve the impacted body part from the work injury. So all of that to me says that a workers' compensation Medicare set-aside may be appropriate here.
Absolutely. Yep, that's the analysis. That is for anyone handling claims in this area, defending claims in this area, bringing claims in this area, you have to interact with Medicare at some point along the way when the person is on Medicare or about to get on Medicare. So we've met that threshold here. Let's assume for the sake of argument that, you know, he is maybe a rather high wage earner in his trade. And there's, you know, significant exposure out there for indemnity. And obviously, we know the total knee replacement has been recommended, even if the carrier is denying it, it's out there. So let's say the value of this case, you know, as Joe is negotiating with the work comp carrier, puts us over that $250,000 threshold. And we've got, you know, relatively conservative clients or folks out there on both sides of the part, on both sides of this case, who really want to go through Medicare's submission process. So when you're looking at MSAs and the folks over at Verisk, as you guys are preparing MSAs, Sid, we have not talked about what jurisdiction this is in, because that's going to be one of the key pieces here that we sort of play with along the way. We're going to switch it up and we're going to talk about what jurisdiction we're in and see how that impacts what we're doing. But can you talk a little bit about, you know, writing an MSA and what you all think about when you know that your client is going to be participating or the parties are going to be participating in that submission process? Maybe talk with us a little bit about, you know, relying on the WCMSA reference guide, because I think that will help us lead into kind of some of these nuances in the state. But can you kind of give us a general idea of Sure. what you're thinking about when you know there's going to be an MSA going to CMS?
Yeah, absolutely. So Annie, you know, mentioned the WCMSA reference guide where Medicare outlines generally their policy and pricing procedures related to Medicare set aside. So when we're submitting an MSA to CMS for review and approval, we very much want to align our review practices and our pricing practices accordingly. So when we submit an MSA to CMS, there's a high likelihood that they'll approve that value so the parties can rely on that for settlement. So things that Medicare will look at is that if certain treatment has been recommended and it's an accepted claim, Medicare is going to try to include that treatment within the Medicare set-aside, absent some type of medical documentation that specifically indicates that it's either not work-related, or if there's a judicial determination on the merits that indicates that that treatment is not work-related, then Medicare may exclude that from the set-aside. But otherwise, the burden is really on the parties to gather that evidence and information to support why certain treatment would be excluded. So based off of this, we would be looking at all the injuries that are currently being alleged by the individual as requiring treatment to be included within the Medicare set-aside. We'd also look at the pay histories to see if there's any payments that have been made for those specific body parts, and other type of, you know, mitigating circumstances that may apply there. Does that
perfect? That's great. So now that we've sort of laid that foundation, let's play around with jurisdiction a little bit. So let's say that we were to venue this case in Georgia. Georgia has some specific laws around non-catastrophic claims and what parties might be able to do there. So can you talk a little bit about what this would look like if we were to write the MSA in Georgia?
Yeah. So Annie, one thing that you mentioned previously is, you know, the reliance on the WCMSA reference guide. So one aspect when we talk about jurisdictional nuances as it applies to Medicare set-asides is that CMS as an entity has indicated that they would accept certain jurisdictional basis to exclude treatment or to alter the allocation of treatment, but it really does require a lot of support. Medicare is not going to make that legal leap. They're not going to necessarily like read a particular statute and determine if something may apply. They really need to be walked down there. So when we look at it from the standpoint of a Georgia jurisdiction, we do have the opportunity to argue that this claim is not catastrophic in accordance with the statutory language. And if so, then there's an opportunity to limit the period of treatment that's allocated within the MSA to 400 weeks. And this is something that Medicare does actually apply. And they'll actually prorate the number of weeks that's already been administered as far as benefits are concerned, if it falls within this the criteria, and only allocate in the MSA for the remainder amount. So there's a great opportunity here if the claim is not designated as catastrophic to argue that in the Medicare set-aside. So when I look at this, I would evaluate again what the treatment is, what the injury is, and determine in accordance with the statute whether it is catastrophic or not. Here, it doesn't appear to be. And the next step I would try to take is then to engage the courts, see if they'll review the facts of the claim and issue an order confirming that it's not catastrophic. And if they do that, then there is a high likelihood that Medicare may reduce the Medicare set aside accordingly and limit it to 400 weeks.
Well, and I really appreciate you saying that, Sid, that last piece about heading back to the court to get an order on the merits, finding that it's not a catastrophic claim. I think for those of us out in the world who, you know, practiced in this area, handled cases like this, or who are doing that now, adjusting cases like this, you might be in the mindset of Georgia, right? You handle Georgia claims, you know this state statute inside and out. And for those of us who wrangle in the work comp courts, it's enough that the statute says what something, you know, what is catastrophic and what is not catastrophic. It is not enough for CMS. If you try to submit this, what happens, Sid, if somebody tells you to submit this using the state statute, but they don't go get that order? Do they have any shot of CMS applying the 400 weeks?
Not likely. In my experience, they're not, as I mentioned previously, they're not going to make the call, right? To your point, if you read the language that indicates what's catastrophic and what's not catastrophic, it seems pretty straightforward to me. However, Medicare is not going to make that legal determination based off of that. They really want to rely on the courts to provide that guidance to them. So in my experience, no, Medicare is likely to not apply the 400 weeks without that documentation.
Absolutely. And same. I mean, there was a time when maybe that was slipping through for a little bit, but gone are those days. And I know folks can get frustrated at, you know, what all you need to submit. So we want to be mindful of that as both Sid and I are walking through this, kind of these caveats, things that may seem, and I know this, right? I'm sure you feel these calls from defense attorneys too. They're like, I'm ready to go. I'm moving on this. And it's like, hold up. We still need one more thing before right. You go.
Absolutely. I was going to say one other thing I wanted to point out about the Georgia 400 weeks as applies to this particular scenario as well, is that the total knee is a little bit trickier now. Georgia revised their application of the 400 weeks, I believe, back in 2019. So they may, if we obtained that judicial determination regarding catastrophic status, we argued the 400 weeks, it's unlikely that Medicare would actually limit the revisions and the treatment related to the total knee if it was allocated within the set-aside, because it's specifically excluded by the statute. So that's something to also keep in mind as well, is that they'll apply that fairly strictly going forward.
Well, and that's a great point too, because one of the things in this fact pattern, I think I was a guest on the podcast a couple months ago, and one of the things that I was bringing up in that one was really this idea of, we know he was involved in a car accident. He was driving to a job site, he gets in an accident, and he hurts his right knee. We know subsequently he gets imaging, and you can see that torn meniscus, but you also see osteoarthritis. I want to know what Joe does. Yes, he works for a flooring company installing carpeting now. Has he been doing that 20 years? Did he start last week? You know, you want to get an idea of the compensability. I think we all kind of agree that the torn meniscus is probably a specific injury that would be, you know, in play here. But it's up for grabs whether or not, you know, he has a cumulative trauma injury that caused the osteoarthritis, or that the carrier would in fact be picking that up. And I think that's what we have in this fact pattern, is you have a carrier denying the total knee because he has that underlying osteoarthritis.
Yeah, and absolutely. So it's very layered, right? So like it's like whether or not you're able to exclude it from the set-aside because you can provide sufficient evidence to indicate that it's non-work-related, it's related to a prior pre-existing non-work, non-industrial condition, then you don't necessarily have to argue it on the 400-week side. But if you're arguing on the 400-week side, you'd still probably have to include that treatment for the full life expectancy, because it's excluded from that particular limitation as well. So absolutely. I would agree with you to start and see if you can just exclude it as non-industrial in the first place.
Absolutely. Well, so that's a little nuance about Georgia. Let's kind of shift this over to, let's say, Oklahoma. I've heard there's the minimum medical maintenance statute there. Can you walk us through a little bit about what this may or may not look like in Oklahoma, kind of like what you did with Georgia?
Yeah, Oklahoma is challenging. So continuing medical maintenance, if an individual reaches, and the statute varies as well, depending on the date of injury and some of the restrictions or allowable handling within that particular state. But at a very high level, if the individual reaches maximum medical improvement, the court may also award what they call continuing medical maintenance. And if they do that, then certain treatment is excluded from what continuing medical maintenance is defined as. One of the things that would be excluded is surgery. So the argument is as if the court is awarded CMM, then you would argue to exclude treatment that was not within continuing medical maintenance. So you could try to argue, even if the treatment related to the total knee was related to the work accident, you could argue if the court awarded CMM that it doesn't apply and the carrier is not responsible for it as a result of that. Also, if there's not a request to essentially alter that ruling or alter the CMM finding, then that's essentially it. So you can significantly limit treatment if it meets that standard at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is one of those ones where you need that ruling essentially finding that it falls within the parameters of what that state statute says. And for those of you who are familiar with the Work Comp MSA reference guide, there is already language in there basically about any finding on the merits. If there's a final ruling on the merits, CMS will typically honor that 9 times out of 10. I think there's very limited instances where they wouldn't. So these state specific things kind of pop right in there. Let's twist it up a little bit. Let's say this entire thing is denied. I mean, I think one of the things that comes to mind for me when I was looking at this fact pattern initially is he's driving to work. If this is kind of his first stop along the way, typically you've got ingress egress laws on the books in various jurisdictions for work comp. And so that would be something when I was in private practice, I would have looked at, you know, is this a defense? How am I going to go, you know, run with this? So let's say we're in a state where you know, they're going to deny based on that. So yes, he hurt his right knee, this accident happened, but they're saying, look, that was on his way to work. He wasn't in the course and scope yet, even though he was driving to a job site, they're going to deny. And then let's actually put this in California. So California has a pay without prejudice period. And I kind of want to get into what happens if this were to be a legal zero. And I think this will be our last fact pattern because we're coming up on time. This is supposed to be part of a two-part series on state specifics. So please listen to the next installment. You'll have a new host and a new guest. But Sid and I will take you through this last kind of fact pattern change up here and talk about what if this were a legal zero and we venue this in a state like California, where maybe there's some payments made while they're investigating it. Take it away, Sid.
Yeah, Annie brings up a good point about the payments, right? So when we talk about a legal zero, and a legal zero, for those that aren't necessarily familiar with it, is arguing that Medicare or there should not be any funds set aside because the claim is denied. So there's no legal responsibility for the future medical treatment associated with the claim. And this is something that Medicare has reviewed as part of their MSA process and has approved as part of their MSA process. But one of the criteria that they really look at is whether or not payments have been made. So the first thing that we try to argue in a legal zero is that it's a fully denied claim. There's been no payments, medical or indemnity, and that's pretty much the threshold standard. So in California, it can be challenging because there's actually a rule in California that a carrier has to make payment during the investigatory period. There's a limit to that, no more than $10,000. There's a time limit to that. So the question is, if payments are made pursuant to this, will Medicare still approve a zero? Can you still argue that? And the answer is yes. Medicare has historically accepted that because, and this is distinguishable from other states with a pay without prejudice statute, like New Jersey has one, I believe, but that's a voluntary pay without prejudice. So there's nothing that actually compels the carrier to pay in New Jersey, but if they pay, it's made, it's conditioned upon, not accepting the claim, right? It's a voluntary pay without prejudice. California is differentiated in the sense that there's no choice. They must make payment. So Medicare accepts that. And as long as it falls within the language of the statute, no more than the statutory period, does not make payment more than $10,000. And you can show that through the pay history, through documentation to the individual and indication of when it was denied or indicating that it's being investigated, then Medicare will still accept that. You still have to meet the other criteria in order to have Medicare approve the $0 MSA, but it will at least get over that initial hurdle of making payments. Annie, I don't know if you have anything else to add to that, but that's my experience with respect to this particular statute.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You nailed it. And I appreciate you chatting a little bit about, the voluntary nature of this kind of provision in a state like New Jersey, because I think for any of us who've practiced in this area, there is this idea that, okay, my client made a payment, but it didn't make the claim compensable. And I'll talk about where I practice. I practice in Minnesota. And in Minnesota, we do not have a law like this on the books. And so, yes, you can make payments and you can retroactively deny primary liability. But because there's no key statute out there, like in California, there's nothing to sort of point to in a very concrete way to excuse those payments you made while investigating the claim. So you venue this, a legal zero like this in Minnesota with some payments having been made during that 90-day provision, no more than 10 grand, and you're still going to be looking at a funded allocation. You're not going to be looking at qualifying on the basis of the legal zero criteria. So it really does matter what state you're venued in and then what those statutes look like. And it seems frustrating, I think, at times that CMS will honor some of these and not others. And I think you hit on that a little bit earlier, Sid, about the 400 week even, right? If this goes into the total knee replacement and surgery, not even qualifying for that 400 week cap anymore.
Right.
So there's a lot of nuances here, depending on what state you're in. And we're not going to be able to get to today, like some of the caps that might be out there. We talked about the 400-week cap in Georgia, but other states have them. There's statutes of limitations, right? Mm-hmm. Those come into play. Apportionment ideas. You've got some states that have second injury funds that will pay for prosthetics after amputations. So there's definitely a lot more to get into. And unfortunately, Sid and I don't have time to go through all of that with you today. But it's a good preview. Stay tuned for the next installment. Like I said, you'll have a different host and a different guest. But our time is up for now. Sid, I would like to thank you so much for coming in today and recording this podcast with us. It has been my pleasure hosting you. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for your time.
No, Annie, it's definitely my pleasure. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
All right. Well, that's it. That's it for this podcast. I do want to remind you all that our annual MSPN educational conference is coming up this fall in Baltimore, September 25th through the 27th. So make sure you're watching the website, you're registering, and hope to see you all there in person. Sid, will you be there in person this year? I will be.
I will be, yes. Looking forward to it.